Usually, when we hear that inventory in a retail market has jumped by like 20%, there is this immediate expectation of relief.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, imagine a massive grocery store finally restocking its empty shelves after a huge supply chain crisis. You expect the customers to just flood the aisles, fill up their carts, and check out.
Right. Supply goes up, transactions naturally follow. I mean, it's the foundational law of supply and demand that we all rely on to make sense of any market,
Yeah,
especially real estate.
exactly. But when you look at the current U.S. housing market right now, that grocery store metaphor just completely falls apart.
It really does.
Because the shelves are definitely fuller, right? Headline housing inventory shot up about 20% back in March of 2025. But the checkout lines, they are completely empty.
Yeah.
It's as if the store restocked, but the manager only put out, imported caviar and $1,000 truffles. Meanwhile, there's a massive line of people outside desperately waiting for just a standard loaf of bread.
That is a perfect analogy. I mean, it is a textbook, real-world definition of a structural mismatch. And for you, listening to this deep dive right now.
Someone we know is a cautious, data-driven real estate investor.
Exactly. For you, navigating the reality of that mismatch is the whole game. You cannot just trade on the headlines anymore.
You really can't. And that is exactly the mission of this deep dive. We are cutting straight through the mainstream media hype that is currently cheering about rising housing inventory.
Because it's a trap.
It is. So we're taking a contrarian, downside-aware look at the hard numbers behind a brand new metric that just dropped, literally just released on May 20th, 2026.
The listing income alignment score.
Yes, from the National Association of Realtors and Realtor.com. We are going to trace this metric back to its roots, expose a critical, psychological flaw in how it defines what a buyer can actually afford,
Which is huge.
and then break down how you can map this data to different investment strategies. Because at the end of the day, you need to find actual yield while protecting your downside risk.
So to truly grasp the power of this new 2026 listing income alignment score, we really have to look at the massive blind spots it was specifically designed to fix.
Right. Let's go back a bit.
Yeah, for decades, traditional housing metrics, things like the Standard Housing Affordability Index, they relied on a very narrow view of the world.
Extremely narrow.
They looked almost exclusively at the median family income, and they based their calculations on backward-looking data, meaning they only looked at homes that had already closed and sold.
Which always felt incredibly short-sighted to me.
Oh, totally.
Relying on median income and closed sales is like, it's like a tailor measuring the average person in a city and then just deciding that the entire town has clothes that fit them perfectly.
Right.
It completely ignores the reality that half the town is taller than average, the other half is shorter. Some people are buying off the rack, and others, well, they can't even afford to walk into the store in the first place.
That is the perfect way to look at it. In a highly polarized economy, the median buyer tells you almost nothing about the lived reality of the broader population or the actual market dynamics at the fringes.
Because the fringes are where the market is actually moving.
Exactly. And that's why back in 2017, NAR and Realtor.com partnered to create something called the Realtors Affordability Distribution Curve and Score.
Okay.
It fundamentally changed the game because, for the first time, it looked at all income percentiles, not
Yeah.
just the median. And crucially, it looked at active listings.
Active listings, like real-time sitting inventory.
Yes. Not just the historical data of what sold last month, but the reality of what is sitting on the market waiting for a buyer today.
Right. But I know they used a fairly complex economic model to build this original 2017 score. They borrowed the Gini coefficient,
They
right?
did.
Wait, hold on. The Gini coefficient is usually used by macroeconomists to measure like wealth and income inequality across entire nations. How do you take wealth inequality math and apply it to a bunch of Zillow listings?
It sounds wild, but think of it as overlaying two different graphs. On the first graph, you plot the cumulative distribution of all active real estate listings in a market.
Ranked from the cheapest to the most expensive.
Exactly. Then on the second graph, you plot the cumulative distribution of all household incomes in that same market, from the lowest earners to the highest.
Okay, so I've got a curve showing housing prices and a curve showing what people actually make.
Right. And you just overlay them. If the two curves perfectly match, meaning the proportion of cheap homes perfectly aligns with the proportion of low-income earners and the expensive homes align with the high earners.
Then the market is perfectly balanced.
Exactly. So the original 2017 score operated on a scale from 0 to 2. 0 meant the curves were so far apart that absolutely no one could afford anything.
Yikes.
A score of 1 meant that perfect equality we just described. And a 2 meant incomes were so incredibly high that every single household could afford every single home on the market.
Which never happens.
Right. But in January 2017, the national score was 0.92.
So really close to 1. The market was actually pretty healthy back then.
It was.
Okay, so fast forward to May 20th, 2026. They've taken that complex mathematical curve and rebranded it as the Listing Income Alignment Score.
Yes, and they shifted it to a much more intuitive scale.
Right, a 0 to 100% plus scale. So a 100% score today essentially means the same thing as the old 1.0. The market is perfectly aligned. The distribution of active listings matches the income distribution of the local households.
Exactly.
And as of March 2026, the national score reached 74.9%.
Which, you know, represents an improvement on paper. It's up from 66.7% in 2025.
Okay.
But if we pull back and look at the historical context, it is still sitting well below the pre-pandemic norm.
Which was what? Around 84%?
84.4%, yeah.
Yeah.
And that 74.9% tells a critical hidden truth about the 2026 market. Households currently only have access to about 3/4 of the housing opportunities they would in a historically normal, balanced market.
Yeah.
This explains exactly why transaction volume stayed completely subdued, even when headline inventory jumped 20%. The market is, as you said earlier, producing the wrong size suits.
Wait, if the market is sitting at a 74.9% alignment, that brings up a massive red flag for me regarding how they are defining access in the first place.
Oh, here we go. Yes.
When this algorithm says a household can afford a home, what is the actual math under the hood? Because from my reading of the methodology, it assumes a scenario that feels totally disconnected from reality.
You're not wrong. The methodology is undeniably rigid. To determine if a home is accessible to a specific income bracket, the algorithm assumes that exactly 30% of a purchaser's gross income goes toward housing costs.
Gross income, not net.
Right, gross. And they are comprehensive about what constitutes that housing cost. It includes the principal and interest on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage.
Plus property taxes.
Yes. Taxes, homeowner's insurance, and crucially, mortgage insurance if the buyer is putting down less than 20%.
Which most buyers are doing. And this is where the contrarian investor has to read between the lines. A 30% debt-to-income ratio for housing costs isn't an average.
No, it's not.
It's practically the mathematical limit for most conventional mortgage underwriting before you start getting into serious risk territory. This metric is calculating what a buyer can spend, mathematically.
Yes.
Not what they should spend, or even what they want to spend.
You're touching on the behavioral finance aspect, which this data completely ignores.
Totally ignores it.
For a cautious investor running a downside-aware portfolio, this means the 74.9% metric is actually highly optimistic.
Highly.
The score measures maximum mathematical purchasing power. It strips away human psychology, economic anxiety, and, you know, the rising cost of literally everything else in a household budget.
Think about it. In this economy, who is voluntarily maxing out their budget to the absolute penny.
Very few people.
If buyers are increasingly conservative right now, maybe they are seeing corporate layoffs in their sector, or they are just feeling the squeeze of inflation on groceries, childcare, gas. They aren't going to want to spend 30% of their gross income on a house.
Exactly.
If they draw a personal line in the sand and decide, hey, I only want to spend 25% of my income on housing so I can keep a cash buffer,
then their purchasing power drops drastically. And the effective alignment of the market plummets right along with it.
Right.
It's likely much lower than 74.9% in reality.
Right.
The data highlights the absolute maximums. This tells us that an investor cannot underwrite a deal assuming their target buyer is going to stretch themselves to the breaking point.
Especially if you're a flipper.
Exactly. If you are a rehabber or a fix and flip investor, where your exit strategy relies entirely on a retail buyer pulling the trigger at your elevated purchase price, the ceiling is your biggest risk factor. The buyer's income is mathematically constrained.
So knowing that this metric is basically a best case scenario ceiling, we have to isolate the damage. Which specific income bracket is hitting their head against that affordability ceiling the hardest right now?
The middle.
Where is the structural mismatch actually concentrated?
It is heavily concentrated right in the middle of the market. Let's look at the data for a household earning around $75,000 a year.
Okay, 75K, solid middle-class income.
Right. Based on that maximum 30% threshold we just unpacked, that buyer can afford a home priced up to roughly $261,140.
Okay, $261,000. That's the magic number for the middle class buyer right now, just to get in the door.
But homes priced below that $261,140 mark currently make up only about 21 to 23% of national listings.
Wow.
In a healthy, balanced market based on historical norms, homes at that entry-level price point should account for roughly 44% of all listings.
Wait, so it should be 44% and it's only at like 22%?
Exactly half of what it should be.
We aren't just talking about a slight dip in inventory. That is a structural black hole in the middle of the American housing market.
The data translates that percentage gap into a national shortage of roughly 311,000 listings, specifically priced under $261,000.
311,000 homes missing.
That is the exact amount of inventory required to hit the market today, just to bring things back into balance for that $75,000 income bracket.
Which makes total sense why the headline inventory bump didn't spur sales. It's like the commercial airline industry.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if airlines looked at their profit margins and just decided to rip out all the economy seats to install luxury first-class pods.
Right.
Suddenly the airport is full of planes, the supply of flights is technically up, but there's a massive crowd of people at the terminal who just need a standard $300 ticket to see their family, and those seats literally no longer exist.
We have to ask why developers aren't building those economy seats. It isn't just greed.
No, it's a structural barrier.
Exactly. A home builder cannot magically produce a $261,000 home if the raw dirt lot costs $80,000 and the municipal zoning and impact fees add another $40,000.
Not to mention the elevated labor and material costs consuming whatever is left.
The math just doesn't work. The margin on an entry-level home is essentially gone, which forces developers to only build higher-end product where they can actually absorb those fixed costs.
Which completely distorts the upper end of the data. Because for upper-income buyers, those making $250,000 or more, they have almost complete access to the market. The algorithm shows over 80% of all active listings are well within their financial reach.
The divergence is staggering. And when you zoom into specific local markets, those extremes get even wilder. Look at Los Angeles.
Oh, man. LA is practically a different planet in this data set.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
It has the lowest alignment score in the country at just 39.4%. A household in LA needs to earn $100,000 a year just to have mathematical access to 4% of the local active listings.
Let that sink in. You are making a six-figure salary, and 96% of the homes sitting on the market are mathematically out of your reach.
And that's even if you are willing to max out your monthly budget.
Exactly. So this structural gridlock forces an investor to be incredibly strategic. If increasing total supply alone won't restore market activity because builders are only constructing for the top tier,
right?
How do you deploy capital without taking on hype-fueled risk? Because if I'm a real estate investor, I can't just throw my hands up and say the market is broken.
No, you still have to operate.
Right. I have capital, I need yield, and I need to map this structural mismatch to a specific profit-driven strategy. From the research, it seems the data points operators toward very distinct geographical plays depending on their motive.
Absolutely.
Let's look at the cash flow-focused operator first. If my priority is immediate day one income over long-term appreciation, maybe I'm a long-term holder where rent coverage dictates my survival, where does this alignment data send me?
It points you directly to the Midwest. The data shows it is consistently the most aligned region in the entire country. Toledo, Ohio, for example, is the number one most aligned market nationally. It boasts a score of 107.4%.
Wait, a score over 100%? That means the market actually has an abundance of housing relative to local incomes, right?
Correct. Akron, St. Louis, Detroit, they are all scoring above that 100% threshold.
Wow.
And what this means for a long-term operator is stabilization. In markets like Cleveland and Indianapolis, you are looking at entry points between $150,000 and $300,000.
Which is incredibly accessible.
They are the ultimate cash flow champions right now because incomes have stabilized while the legacy housing stock remains accessible.
And it's not just cheap houses for the sake of cheap houses. Cleveland, for example, offers exceptionally favorable rent-to-price ratios because the tenant pool is anchored by massive recession-resistant institutions.
The hospitals and universities.
Exactly. You have the Cleveland Clinic, Case Western Reserve University. These eds and meds provide a stable base of middle-income renters. You can realistically achieve positive cash flow from day one with a standard 25% down conventional loan, which is almost impossible on the coast right now.
But, you know, there is a trade-off. The Midwest generally lacks explosive population growth. So if an investor wants stronger demographic momentum, they have to pivot their strategy.
Exactly. Let's say I'm willing to sacrifice some of that immediate day one cash flow because I'm worried about stagnant population growth in those older Rust Belt cities.
Right.
If I want to capture demographic momentum and aim for balanced growth, maybe targeting 6-9% cash on cash returns, but banking on 5-7% annual appreciation, the data shifts us away from the Midwest entirely.
That takes you straight into the Sun Belt. You're moving away from purely cash flow preservation and investing in employment-driven migration.
Like Texas.
Yes. Dallas-Fort Worth, for instance, was ranked as PwC's number one overall real estate market for 2026. The diversity of its economy spanning finance, tech, logistics, makes it incredibly resilient to sector-specific downturns.
Nashville is another massive standout in the data. It has completely transformed from a purely tourism and music-driven economy into a major corporate hub.
Huge corporate hub.
Oracle relocated its headquarters there, Amazon expanded its operations, and you have massive healthcare conglomerates. Plus, the lack of a state income tax is a massive draw for high-income professionals migrating from the coasts, which virtually guarantees steady rental demand.
And Phoenix is capturing a very similar dynamic, primarily serving as a pressure release valve for California.
It's a pure cost of living arbitrage play.
Exactly. Established households are relocating there for a better financial setup. However, the data-driven investor has to look at the specific risk in the Sun Belt, primarily the multifamily construction pipeline.
Because developers have been building like crazy down there to meet the migration demand.
A historic amount of new inventory. So if you were investing in Phoenix or Dallas, you need to focus on the growing lower-density suburbs where competition is constrained.
That makes sense.
If you buy into an area with concentrated, massive new multifamily construction, those institutional developers will offer 2 months of free rent to lease up their buildings, which will temporarily crush your rental rates and squeeze your margins.
Okay, so the Midwest offers high alignment and cash flow, while the Sun Belt offers demographic growth but pipeline risks.
Yep.
What about the contrarian value plays? What if I'm an advanced investor, maybe a rehabber looking for a distressed entry price, and I'm looking at the 22 major metros that the data shows are currently seeing outright price declines?
Navigating declining markets requires an entirely different level of underwriting. Let's look at Tampa and St. Petersburg in Florida.
Okay.
Post-correction, the entry points are noticeably lower than Miami, and the local economy is diverse. But the massive variable that is destroying spreadsheet projections in Florida right now is the insurance crisis.
And this is where that downside-aware framing is absolutely life or death for a deal.
Literally.
You might find a property in Tampa that looks like an absolute steal based on the purchase price. But if you don't aggressively underwrite the reality that property insurance premiums might double in the next 2 years.
Or that your carrier might pull out of the state entirely.
Exactly. Forcing you onto a vastly more expensive state-backed plan, your entire profit margin evaporates overnight.
The exact same cautionary logic applies to inland California metros. Places like Sacramento, Fresno, and Bakersfield are offering a 30 to 50% discount on entry prices compared to coastal hubs like San Francisco or LA.
And you certainly have strong rental demand from people who have been mathematically priced out of the coast.
But a truly data-driven contrarian doesn't just run blindly into a discount. You have to ask why the asset is cheap. Is it a temporary oversupply, which is an opportunity to buy at the bottom? Or is there a systemic drag on the asset's performance?
So what's the systemic drag in California?
The regulatory and tax environment. The data strongly suggest that if you are operating there, you need to budget 12 to 15% of your gross rents just for property management.
Wait, 15%? Why so high? The national average is like 8 to 10%.
Because you're dealing with statewide rent control caps that limit your upside. You have incredibly complex eviction procedures that drag out timelines.
Oh, right.
And you have the reality of Prop 13. When you purchase that property, the taxes are reassessed at your new purchase price, meaning your cash flow will look radically different than the seller's historical numbers.
That's a huge trap for a new investor.
Massive. Execution separates the winners from the dreamers in these contrarian markets. The margin for error is razor thin. If you don't have deep local market expertise, trusted boots on the ground, and substantial capital reserves to weather extended hold periods.
The data tells us you should stay far away.
Stick to the aligned cash-flowing Midwest.
So bringing this all together, the takeaways from this deep dive are pretty clear. The 2026 listing income alignment score mathematically proves that headline inventory growth is a complete illusion if it's the wrong type of inventory.
It's just noise.
Right. If the new supply doesn't align with the financial capacity of the buyer, The checkout lines stay empty and the market stays frozen.
And because this metric measures the absolute maximum ceiling of what buyers can spend, risk-aware investors must factor in human behavior. The effective real-world alignment is definitely lower than the 74.9% headline score.
Yeah.
Recognizing that massive 311,000-unit void in the middle market is the first step. The second step is deploying your capital based on a strategy that respects that data. Whether that means acting as a cash flow operator in the Midwest, seeking balanced demographic growth in the Sun Belt, or carefully navigating contrarian value plays with your eyes wide open to insurance and regulatory risks.
Which leaves us with a pretty massive question to ponder for you listening. We talked about how the factory isn't building the sensible sedans anymore.
Right.
If the data shows a seemingly unfillable shortage of entry-level homes, and builders have absolutely no financial ability to build them because land, labor, and regulatory costs are too high, does this permanently reshape the American dream into a renter-by-necessity economy?
It's a heavy thought.
It is. If an entire generation of middle earners is effectively locked out of home ownership, not by a lack of desire, but by structural math, does that make the long-term cash flow-focused landlord the ultimate winner of the 2026 market reset?
Definitely something to consider.
Yeah. It's definitely something to think about the next time you see a headline celebrating rising inventory.